Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
Hello, Kirsty Rice. How are you? Hey, have you had your atlas out? Who knew there were so many cities and countries started with the letter A?
Yep, and who knew we had so many people in the Facebook group who'd lived in places that started with an A? Did you know where Argyll and Ashgabat was? And I'm sure I haven't said those properly.
No, I didn't know where those places were. I do admit those and a couple more, I did do a bit of a Google sneak peek. But what a great idea you've had, Kirsty, and what great fun we're going to have over the next 26 podcasts doing the A to Z of places in the world. Anyway, we should probably talk about that in the podcast.
Yes, I want to hear about your interview with the woman who lived in Arusha. Okay, shall we make a podcast?
Yes, let's do it.
Hi there, I'm Kirsty Rice, an Aussie expat based in Qatar. Welcome back to our new and improved Two Fat Expats podcast, where we talk all things expat, screwing up our expat children, finding the best locations to live, and not blowing our expat dough. How's your big fat expat week been, Nikki Moffat?
Well, Kirsty Rice, I upped my culture this week. I went to a women's forum titled Nevertheless, She Persisted for the American Women's Club in Hamburg. It was a panel discussion and it had a focus on US-related topics, but they did include a female German senator who's from Hamburg, but I think she's a national senator. It was so interesting being there. The discussion was mainly about the US and Germany, but the room was full of women. Actually, the room was really full, and it was full of women from all over the globe. So when they got to the Q&A at the end, it was fascinating to hear the different countries they came from and the sort of questions that they had that weren't, you know, really. I'm so glad I went because I nearly didn't, because it was freezing and grim and yeah. I had to drive to a random part of town. And I learned a very interesting thing, that until 1975, a woman had to have her husband's permission to go to work in Germany. 1975.
Wow. God. And it always, you know, you think about countries like Germany being so incredibly progressive, right?
You do, but I have to tell you, there is the patriarchy is alive and well in Germany, the way that a lot of things are set up here. But having said that, their political parties do have quota systems. So the German senator talked a lot about how people spoke to her, you know, you just have your job because of the quota system. You know, you wouldn't have this sort of important portfolio if we didn't have a quota that you had to have it. So, and even that, you know, is discrimination in a way that people talk to her like that. So it was eye-opening. And I'm very glad I went.
Did you go on your own or did you take a friend?
I went on my own, but I did know people that were there. But yeah,
I'm impressed. So you got in your little German car and drove down your German street and found yourself to a new German location. Were you speaking German all the way?
I was not, but the whole thing was in English, thankfully. And the panelists were also in English, obviously, because it was held by the American Women's Association. But one of the women was there, people spoke from the point of view of their life experiences and where they come from. There was a woman from education. There was a woman from investment banking. And there was one woman who from the arts world. So talking about performing artists and musicians and composers and, you know, it was so, like, because that's in a world that I have absolutely no exposure to. And it was just really interesting. I found her the most interesting person when she spoke, because that was sort of a world that I just had no concept of. Glad I went.
Good, good, good. Nikki, was that an International Women's Day event? Like, is that why? Was it sort of classed around the same time?
Yes, it was, because it's part of the celebrations for International Women's Month and International Women's Day, which I know that podcasts are timeless, but in reality, International Women's Day is tomorrow.
Now, on that, I would love if any of our listeners are doing anything for International Women's Day around the world. So before we get started, dear listener, I'd love to hear what you're doing for International Women's Day, or if you're doing anything, or if you don't feel you need to do anything. But you can drop us a line, send us a message, and let us know what happens in your part of the world. So if you haven't sent us a message yet, Nikki, can you tell people how to do it?
Sure. Sure I can, Kirsty. The best way to send us a voice message that we will hear pretty much straight away is to go to www.twofatexpats.com and click on the microphone. You click on the microphone and you can speak to us. Speak to us and we'll get the message. We'd love to hear from you.
On to expat relationships, Nikki. Tell me about your expat relationship this week.
This week, my husband's in Costa Rica. I drove him after last week's podcast. I don't believe I did, but I drove him at 5 o'clock to the airport on Saturday morning so he could go and spend the weekend with my friends in Atlanta on his way to Costa Rica. And he's in Costa Rica. So mainly this week we've been communicating via WhatsApp. We have actually had a couple of more serious parenting items going on, but it actually is harder to discuss, you know, with his work and meetings and whatever, like over the phone, because it's only usually when the kids are here and we're talking about the kids. So it's a bit tricky. So we've been WhatsApping. That's what we've been doing this week.
Yeah, I find that. And if Greg and I are apart, and yeah, you do realize so much of what you talk about is the kids and decisions that need to be made about the kids. But there you all are staring at each other on FaceTime, and you then have to have a separate FaceTime with your husband. Yeah, you know, what we found was I would FaceTime with everybody in the morning, or, you know, we do house party, but, you know, same thing. I would do that with everybody there, and then Greg and I would have to have a separate call as he drove to work where we actually talked about the real nitty gritty. You know, the boring
That's
stuff,
right.
You know, the finance, the, you know, who needs to be told what, who needs to be pulled into line, you know, the serious stuff, yep. Whereas we had this
fluff. Emails from the school.
Yes. Now, tell me if I'm doing something, if I'm violating my children's rights here. I had this idea with Expat Tech. I'm not sure if you've ever done it. Poster Candy, have those? Have you seen them with Instagram? And you can put your Instagrams into posters. Have you ever done that?
Oh, I have Instagram magnets on my fridge, but I haven't ever done the poster one. But yes, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
So we've been doing them yearly, I guess, for about the last, 3 to 4 years, I guess, when I think about how many posters we have. And it's a fantastic idea because you go through your Instagram, you pick all your favorite Instas, and they set you up with different sizes, but the sizes usually match the frames at IKEA, which is perfect for the expat who usually
perfect
home. And so we've got a couple at the beach, we've got a couple here, but I had this idea now because, you know, the kids and I, there's so many more phone chats than there are, you know, face being together in real time, that I would start doing screenshots of our phone chats, because we have, you know, these house parties where there's, you know, that all six of us are in, or maybe three of us are in, or maybe just two of us are in, and it shows different times of the day, different things. And then I would then do a little poster candy of that. And I'm thinking they're either going to absolutely kill me and say, I cannot believe you did this, which they probably will. But I'm also thinking that it's going to capture a certain part time in our lives, you know, this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's exactly what I was thinking. So yes, they'll probably hate you, but they're not going to take it with them to university into their first share house or whatever. Like, they'll leave it at mum and dad's. And it's one of those things. It's like when we talk about leaving a place, what do you take photos of? You know, you take photos of your kitchen and, you know, your bathroom, and remember how we had to lean this way to do that on the tap. And it's the same kind of thing. Remember when we had this time in our life and we were connected this way?
Yes.
You know, this is what it looked like. And I think it's perfect. I think it's a lovely idea. I don't care what the kids say.
And just to elaborate on that, Nikki, what you've said about taking pictures of kitchens and bathrooms and whatever, for those who didn't listen, we did have an episode where people talked about that, didn't they, about things they wish they would have done before they left. And it's huge, because I do not have all those pictures of my house in Jakarta or certain things in KL that I would love to have to jog my memory. You know, the house we lived in Libya was so unique. And, you know, now when I look back at pictures of the kids, as much as I'm looking at them when they're little, I'm also going, wow, we had a sand pit in the backyard in Libya. And remember how we used to entertain and we'd have people sneak around in that little corner of the backyard? And they're the memories that you're desperately trying to hang on to, is exactly what those bathrooms look like, those backyards. Yes. Yeah, no, bang on. Anyway, what about you for expat tech?
Well, I've had a lot of problems with my internet this week. So what I suggest is that you never let your internet go down when you're living in a country when you can't speak the language because it's very, very frustrating. And it's more frustrating when it happens on a weekend and you've got two and it's minus 11 outside and there's two tween teenagers saying, the internet's down, the internet's down. And you're spending sort of 2 hours trying to get, first of all, it took me about 10 calls to get through the IVR. It kept saying, I'm sorry, in German, you've entered the wrong information. We're going to end the call now. And I'd be like, I don't know what I did. Anyway, it was very frustrating. So that.
Have you got your internet back now?
Well, we do because I'm talking to you, but it's hit and miss. I'm just going to go through the whole thing and cross my fingers. But we are having a technician come later today and we're also getting our new modem either today or tomorrow. But I have – they keep sending me text messages saying, your ticket is closed. And I keep ringing them and saying, no, don't close my ticket. The internet's not.
Do you think potential expats think about these things that, you know, when they're discussing the job contract and they're discussing housing and, you know, schooling for their kids, that there isn't a big, you know, bullet point thing that says, and by the way, you're going to go absolutely spare one day when you're trying to get your internet connected because you know how hard it is in your own country. Try it in a different language.
And that's the thing. And people say, well, you know, you can just get one of your friends. I'm like, sure, at, you know, 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, I'll just call one of my many German-speaking friends and ask them to come because they say you have to be standing in your living room. You have to be looking at the lights on the modem. And I was like, well, I think that's what they say because it's all in German. But anyway, my technical German vocabulary has improved this week. So what can I say? I guess that's something.
I heard a fabulous expat internet story this week where, let's say, 500 different homes of people that work for a company that possibly may have merged with another company recently. Those 500 homes, so imagine they're all in an area together. And some smart bunny in HR says, no, we're not going to have the phones in the company name anymore. We're going to have each individual person can have their own name on their own phone. So we'll just cut that off, oh, I don't know, tomorrow. And so anyone who is sitting in their house, you know, those 500 homes, and they're sitting there with their tweens and teens and toddlers, and suddenly, not, you know, it's no big deal if your phone goes. I mean, who uses a landline? But it's a bloody big deal when it's connected to your internet. And nobody's got any internet and nobody knows why, because it's a surprise.
You mean there wasn't an email from HR to tell you, oh, in the next 12 hours you need to contact the provider and change the name?
I believe not. So, yes, I heard that story via a friend yesterday and just the joy of, you know, then getting told, and actually you're going to have a new phone number. So they're trying to think of all the people. You know, when someone suddenly says your phone number's different and then you go, well, I really have no idea who that affects, you know, or what I have to do.
New phone number. Oh,
I know.
Oh, no, new phone number sucks. Right. Now, just lastly, quickly, on the expat tech, I have to tell you, Kirsty, are you familiar with the pop socket?
Yes, I am familiar with the pop socket. I did see a pop socket on your Insta this week, Nikki Moffat.
That's right. I have recently gone to with my daughter to, I don't know why, to a shop, and she spent about 50 minutes deciding which pop socket she wanted to buy with her money. She wanted me to buy three and I said, no, you only have one phone. You only need one pop socket. So a pop socket, for all the cool kids will know what it is. It's something that goes on the back of your phone and it's ingenious because, you know, phones are getting bigger and bigger and the bigger the screen, the better, really, let's be honest. In the olden days, it used to be the smaller, the better. It's like a a little handle on the back of your phone that pops in and out. So it can be quite flat, or you can pull it out like an accordion and you pull it out, and then you can use your fingers to hold it. So it's much easier to hold in your hand than having to put your whole hand around.
Yes, I watched my son pull his pop socket out yesterday to rest the phone while we followed the slime recipe. So yes, they are very, very handy. You're not sort of having to hover right over the top of your phone. You can tilt it up. Yes.
You can tilt your phone, you can set it up, you can watch movies, but you can also hold it in your hand. So it's much, you don't have to put your hand around the whole back of your phone.
Yes.
Like it makes it much easier. So I think it'd be good for people with hand problems from maybe holding their phone too much. I don't know anyone who that might be. I'm not just saying that it might be good. Anyway, my daughter looked at 100 pop sockets, and then I came home and I thought, you know what? I think I'd like a pop socket, but I think I'd like to design my own. So I did. So I went on the internet, designed one, and got it sent to me. And you can see the photo of that at the Two Fat Expats Instagram page. And also now I have a whole house of people wanting to design their own pop sockets. So I created one.
I want one like yours. So for those who are rushing to the website now to have a look, Nikki got a Two Fat Expats pop socket, and it's very cool. So it's got the Two Fat Expat symbol and name. It's black and white. It's very, very funky, and I want one, and I'm going to get my own one as well. You should put it up on the Facebook group, see if anyone else wants one. Expat kids. I'm trying to think about how this came about. So I think last week in the Two Fat Expats Facebook group, I posted that we had a couple of really good interviews for last week's podcast. And Marsha put a note up saying, hey, do you think you could talk about expat kids applying to universities? Like, will they stay in their expat country? Will they go back? Well, she used the term alma mater, which isn't an Australian term at all, but, you know, she meant, will they go back to where you went to university? Will they go back near your family? Do they go somewhere completely different? And it started off this little conversation. Like, there were a whole lot of posts that sort of began from that thread of people who had teenage and university age children talking about what their children had chosen to do, what they were concerned about, what they'd, you know, what sort of family decisions. Because I wonder, Nikki, your thoughts on this, because, you know, back when we started our expat life, which was, I think, you know, 18, 19 years ago,
with no children,
but I was pregnant, so I guess I was always thinking about it, do you know? I just remember this huge amount of people that went home, do you know, once their children got to a certain age. There was this always big conversation about, you know, we have to get them home for high school. We've got to get them home for high school. And it only occurred to me today, that not so many people, it doesn't seem to be so urgent. Is it because my children are of that age now, and so I hang around with a lot of people that don't send their children home? But, you know, like the whole family would leave. The whole family would say, well, we have to get our lives back to the country, to whatever. And I just don't think it happens now, because we all see that the world's a lot smaller and we have more choices. I thought Bernadette was interesting. She said that her children said they wouldn't go back to Australia, and Bernadette's Australian. She said they hadn't lived there since they were 10 and 11, so they stayed in the UK, and they were very lucky that they had a UK citizenship. She said, in her personal opinion, she's noticed that US kids are very happy to go back to the US for college, even if they've never lived there. And I agree with her, and I think that's got a lot to do with the whole setup of US university with their residencies.
Absolutely.
And whatever. Because everybody's new. Everybody starts at a university and they all live in residence and they're all new to that city, so it's such a big deal. But she said, you know, she's started thinking about, well, where is the family going to end up living and the unintended consequences of expat life. Nikki, university, is that too far away for you that you just don't even think about it, or what do you think?
Oh, not really, no. I think it's two phases. So we left with a baby, like he was 11 months old when we left, and we said, oh, we'll be back by high school. Absolutely. I mean, we left for 3 years and the deadline was high school. He's in grade 9, so whichever country you come from, that's considered high school. And we have talked about it a lot with my eldest son, it's not really such an option for him at the moment to go back to Australia to boarding school. And we don't really know whether he's going to go to university straight away or do something else, or if he'll do something else altogether rather than university. With my daughter, that's more a linear process. So she can see her life going school, university, etc., gap year, whatever, maybe. Depends how hard she works on saving money for that. And so we have thought about that, and we have talked to her about that, and she would like to go to school in Australia from 9 to 12. And then so she's sort of culturally assimilated a little bit, and then sort of go on to university from there is the plan. Having said that, I don't think we would send her to boarding school in Australia if we still lived in Europe, because it's just so far away. So we'll just have to consider that. We don't expect to be in Europe when she's in grade 9, but we also don't know. So yeah. Not really plans, but kind of formulating.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing with me. I am such a long-term planner, probably not a short-term planner, but I do think about the future over and over and over again in my head. And so for me, I am fascinated when people go, we just never really thought about how this would pan out. I'm like, how did you not think about it? Do you know, how is this not keeping you up at night? Melissa said both of her boys went to uni in Australia but chose as many overseas studies opportunities as they possibly could. They went to Ghana, The Hague, Barcelona, one even finished one degree and then applied for a scholarship to a uni in Paris. He now works in Amsterdam. And I do see that happening with my kids. I think while they're quite happy, my big two that are back in Australia, while they're quite happy getting those friends, making that life, doing whatever, they have both expressed an interest in doing future studies elsewhere, and that's fine. I have no qualms with that, as long as they've got their little base in Australia, you know, as long as they've got that group of friends to come back to, as long as they feel they've got that relationship to Australia, I'm cool. Jodie said both of her sons are in UK universities and have assured us they never plan to return to live in Australia because it's too far from the rest of the world, which is so true and something that Europeans tell you all the time, but it's not something you hear from Australians often.
Well, they've been away 6 years, so they might consider themselves European now. But she did say, Jodie also said, it's not something that they don't know where they'll end up, and they didn't really think about all that when they left Australia six years ago.
Jodie's a far more free spirit than I, that's for sure. I love that wanderlust of who knows, let's just wait and see. Do you know, I wish I had a bit more of that, but I'm not. I'm far more, okay, let's get this locked in. Let's know how this is going to work. You know, it's quite bizarre. So, Laurelyn, Laurelyn had written a comment about her son as well and what they were going through, and I really wanted to speak to her because she had a situation that a lot of Europeans have to face, and that was when you hear Laurelyn speak, you'll hear that she has a Canadian accent when she's speaking English, but she married a Swedish man and she is bilingual and she now lives in Sweden. They have a holiday home in Sweden. Their two eldest children live in Sweden. They are very much Swedish. And so Laurelyn had two children who are bigger. They're in their 30s. And then they adopted a child when he was 4 years old. And they took off on their expat adventure when he was 7. I'll play Laurelyn's interview now and you can see how that's panned out for her.
So he was in Sweden till the year he turned 7, and that's when we made our expat move. From there, we went to Azerbaijan, and then from there, we went to Qatar, then to China, then to the United Arab Emirates, and that's where he finished school. But he definitely identified with being Swedish. He did flirt a bit with going to the UK, but that was very short-lived. And when it came down to actually making the decision to do it, he said no, he wanted to go home. We have a summer house in Sweden in the archipelago, not a year-round residence. His two older brothers, of course, live in Stockholm. He was going to move into his own apartment.
Did you have some concern that he didn't have a network there in Sweden?
We knew that if he had an emergency, he had his brothers. But given that they're in their early 30s with young families of their own, the day-to-day network did worry us a bit. We did give him the option to come and stay with us, and he declined. Beautifully, but he declined nonetheless.
Right.
He said he really wanted to go back. We helped him find an apartment last summer, and we set up as many systems as we could. We use everything from, he gave us access to his bank account, for example, so that his father can log in here and he can log in there if he has any questions, and they can both look at the same screen. This was his choice. He said he needed this because he was very, very aware of the language, and that did concern us a great deal. It's somewhat like Germany. While they do speak English, there's a bit of a culture crash, too, in that if you are Swedish, you are expected to know, not to ask, to know. And not just the language, but to know everything from how to apply for a driver's license to filling in a government form to anything. So after a couple of missteps, he really appreciated how solid the advice was, and he will take photographs of everything and send it. Getting him an apartment was not a problem. Even making sure he could pay his bills, because that was a little bit easier. But it's the other things that he's been running up against that have been a struggle, and that has been the frustration. He had to hit the ground on his own. He basically decided that this is what he wanted to do. He got involved with a volunteer group last summer. That was the start of some friendships. And through taking Swedish classes, he's managed to build a network of friends there as well. We had a bad phone call where he was very frustrated with one of the government job search body. And he was very stressed, very frustrated. He'd been mistaken for an immigrant by his, I guess the English word would be handler or case manager. So he had been mistaken as an immigrant first time out. And he kept calling us last fall and saying, how can I get a work permit? And we're like, Stefan, you don't need a work permit. You're Swedish. You can't get a work permit not to work in your own country. And we couldn't figure out what this was. And it took about a month and a half. And at that point, he was even assigned, he had even found a job under this program, only to find out that it was for immigrants only. He, of course, was not an immigrant. So he has run up against this a couple of times. Even taking the Swedish course that he's taking, technically, it's only for non-Swedes. So it's funny because he does have a mix of friends, but I would say they're two-thirds foreigners, either a lot of university students studying in Sweden, or pre-university students, or relatively recent immigrants. And then the other third are born there Swedes. We always thought somehow that he would, being in an international school, staying in an international school, that he would end up going to an English-speaking university. By grade 11 and 12, and when he had decided he wanted to go back, you sort of start taking steps back and you look back over your previous decisions and you think, well, maybe I should have fought harder to get him exempted from this language or the other language, even if he wouldn't have fit in with the rest of the kids at school, but you want your child to fit in. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should have sat him down for an extra hour of homework every day and taught him proper written Swedish, government Swedish, taught him how to fill out forms. Well, I mean, my husband laughed about this a few months ago and said, what should we have done? Sat there, downloaded every Swedish government form there was and made him do it for practice. I mean,
when you said before you always thought he'd choose an English-speaking university and maybe go to the UK, were you hoping for that to happen, or were you hoping for him to, like, you know, we all have our preferences as parents. What were you hoping he would do?
That's a good question. I knew he would go back to Sweden eventually. I think as a parent, as a mum, of course, I'd want him to choose the easier path. And I think, or I thought, that perhaps the easier path was further education in the UK. He needed to go back. And I don't know if it was because he lived overseas for so long. We went home every summer. And, you know, he had the usual school national days where you parade around in your country's colors and you eat the food and you go back in the summer and you bring back things and you're all excited. But I think part of him, maybe it was part of being adopted. I think he needed to go home.
Well, Wow. Just that is quite, it's quite confronting, yeah. Really, isn't it? The information that she had in there that she shared. It's, you know, all the things that you lie awake and yes. worry about.
And you know, I've had this conversation a lot with friends who are Dutch, and, you know, where they say the same thing. Oh, you know, all of my kids have friends who are Dutch who have to go to Dutch lessons, you know, at least twice a week. And
yeah, Dutch school.
And because it's this whole fear of when they go back to university, they are not going to be able to grammatically write essays and do things like that. They can speak Dutch, but could they get a university degree in that language? Maybe not. And I found with Laurel, and it was so interesting that, you know, after she'd had this child who had gone to English-speaking schools all the way through, that there was this feeling in the back of her mind of, well, of course he'll probably choose an English-speaking university to go to. And he suddenly went, no, I don't want to do that. It's too, I think in his words, England was too English for him.
I think it's what Laurelyn has put in there is great information for all the parents that are thinking about this and maybe haven't thought about it and maybe now thinking about it because of that. I think it was very real and honest, and the good tips like the shared bank account details. And is that because, you know, there are things on there that are in Swedish and he doesn't know if he presses yes. the right button where the money's yeah. going to go?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And she said it seems like, because, you know, I remember my first year out of school, I had to go to what was, you know, it was the job centre, and I had to go and register and do all of those things. You know, oh, that'd be the mosque, everyone, if you're wondering what that noise is in the background.
Call to prayer.
I'll be back in a minute. There are so many things that he's doing that are tough for any kid who's venturing out in the world, you know, to become an adult. But he's doing it. He's like a junior expat with no partner, no job support. Do you know, like, he's really out there because he's chosen to take this gap year. He hasn't gone straight to university. So he's got this year to sort of work and get his life together. But it seems so tough.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's probably, it'd be interesting, but it's probably something that faces quite a lot of TCKs or ATCKs, adult third culture kids, who've lived one life and then choose to go and live. I mean, that was his choice to go to Sweden, right? And so he's picked the harder route, really, because he's got to go and face this massive language barrier. And also the fact that everyone he deals with thinks he's an immigrant, which, you know, is also, you know, it's a very tricky. And I can see why, you know, she talks about his friends being, you know, some of them Swedish, but a lot of them being sort of either other people in the same situation as him and or immigrants, because they're the ones that are facing, which was what we say every time when you move somewhere, you've got to find people who are like you in the same stage as yeah. you, because they're the people that are going to help you get through it in the beginning. And then you can sort of branch out to all sorts of different people, but you really need those people that are going to understand exactly how you're feeling and what you're going through. It must be so hard for them as parents to watch it from afar. It must be
yes,
so hard.
And both working, right? So the idea of just hopping on a plane and zipping back and helping out whenever you like is not there because, you know, both parents are working. You know, it goes back to, you know, I made a choice to send our kids to boarding school first so that they could maybe rub a little bit of that off, the hardship away in a safer environment. Yep. You know, I've watched, I had no idea that my daughter didn't know how to write on an envelope. She seriously did not know how to address an envelope to somebody. I missed it. I didn't know that she didn't know what a news agency was. I didn't know that she...
Come on. So many countries don't have news agencies.
And, you know, so when people were saying, you know, just go and just zip across to the news agency and get your bus card or your student card or whatever, and her going, huh? And, you know, she went to write a thank you card to someone and she took a picture of the envelope and sent it to me and said, have I got this right? And I was like, oh, my God, you've written on the back of the envelope. Like you've written interest on the back.
But you know what she can do? She can travel internationally by herself. She can go to an airport and work out where she has to go. She can go through customs and immigration. You know, she
That's
has
right.
other
skills. That's right. That's exactly it. They're amazing, these kids, with their international smarts, but their lack of everyday. Yeah. Shall we move on to expat money? I was talking last week about I had an email from my husband that went to our entire family telling us how much the electricity bill was this month. It was a very calm email, but it basically said, this is the electricity bill this month. This was the electricity bill last month. Let's all work together to make sure we can get it back down to what it was last month. Please remember to, you know, to switch off the lights, to do this, to do that, to do this. And my husband has been doing this since we moved house here in Doha, because we, in the past, our electricity bill used to be absorbed as part of our package, whereas we now pay our electricity bill. And so our kids are suddenly having to be more conscious. And I was asking in the Two Fat Expats group about expat kids and money. I think Jackie Rowan really made a really brilliant point that we all identify with, where she was saying in the Facebook group that they're struggling with it with their college-based daughter at the moment because she's prevented from working due to visas. And she said she's grown very comfy with the bank of mum and dad and comes across as very entitled. And they're trying to fix that now. And I think that if you asked any parent what they didn't want from their teen, that would be it. None of us want a child that appears to be entitled.
Absolutely. It's one of those words like disappointed. Yeah. You don't want your parents to be disappointed in you. You don't want anyone to call your kid entitled, or for him or her to come across that way.
Yeah, we want our kids to be hardworking, and we want our kids to be grateful. And, you know, I think my proudest moments of my kids are when someone says, oh, I picked your daughter up and took her to softball and she bought me a little box of, you know, Rose's chocolates to say thank you. And you go, oh, wow. Now, we had another message come in from Misha, didn't we, on the website. Nikki, do you want to explain how Misha left us the message on the website?
Oh, yes, I do. So what Misha did was she went to www.truefatexpats.com and she pressed on the microphone and she spoke into it. And then the message magically went across the interwebs and came to us. And now we're going to play it for you.
Hi, my name is Misha. I am an ATCK currently living in Dubai with my partner, who calls himself a baby expat because this is his first expat posting. He's originally American and I'm originally Indian. And lately, as I'm about to turn 30, I've been wondering how to make our money work for us. We're pretty good about where our money goes each month. We set aside the money for our bills, savings, groceries, things like that. And the rest, what's left over, goes to our fund budget. But more and more, I'm wondering how to make it work in the long term for when we eventually want to settle down and have a good nest egg to rely on. How do we go about doing that in expat context, and especially in terms of a millennial expat context? Because my package and his package is definitely not comparable to what our parents' expat packages used to be. It's a competitive world out there, and companies are not as generous as they were. So I was wondering if you guys had tips, especially Kirsty, having worked with the Barefoot Investor, how to go about sorting that out. Love the podcast. Thanks for what you guys are doing. Have a great day. Bye.
Okay, I loved Misha's message. I love it because she's young, and I love the idea that there's young women listening to us. Hooray. Hello, Misha, how are you? Thank you for leaving your message. And, yes, this is something we are going to talk about a lot more. Now, I know I said this last week, I was going to come back and play a little snippet of my husband and I talking about our budget and our expenses. I haven't edited it yet and it did go for way too long, but I've realized that this is much bigger than us. It may involve maybe setting up another little website and putting some more information down on a website as well, because there's lots and lots that I want to put down about expat budgets and expat money and how we're going to talk about this. So Misha, just bear with me. I will be there in the next couple of weeks and we'll get it set up and I'll get some information for you on how to budget, how to talk about money and what to do expat money. But wasn't she absolutely bang on about how packages have changed and gone are those expat millionaire days?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what that's the things that struck me too was she's less than 30 and she's listening to us. Less than she's younger than 30 and she's listening to us. That and that she had those questions, which were all very mature, I thought. I thought, oh, I wish I was thinking about that when I was under 30. And yeah, and the thing to do with package changes. Yeah, the markets are a lot more competitive. People are prepared to make different choices. And yeah, absolutely. Totally fantastic. Now, Kirsty, location, location, location.
Yes. So for a little bit of fun, I put on the Facebook group the other day how we'd all lived in so many locations and I thought we could make our way through the alphabet. And I put in there, okay, who's lived somewhere that starts with A? Well, I don't know, 250 comments later. So, Nikki, Arusha. I know you're busting to tell me about when you went to Arusha.
Kirsty, did I ever tell you about the time I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro?
Oh, I've never mentioned it before. No, I don't know if you've ever mentioned that before.
Anyway, when you climb Mount Kilimanjaro, you fly into Arusha, or Arusha is your base that you leave from to go up to the mountain. So I spoke this week to Karen from Arusha. And, well, Karen lived in Arusha for 5.5 years and she moved back to the UK towards the end of last year, which was a repatriation. So her family had been away for 15 years and they lived in Brazil, the Netherlands, Canada and Tanzania, which is, of course, where Arusha is. So Karen was the lead expat with her husband and 3-year-old accompanied her to the Arusha at the time, and she worked for a Canadian NGO called Farm Radio International. So let's listen to Karen.
It's quite small, not so many people have heard of it. It supports small-scale farmers, really, by giving them information via radio. We work with local radio stations in 8 or 9 countries in Africa, and we train the broadcasters to make really good and really fascinating radio programs about agriculture. And the idea is that farmers don't have, you know, most farmers in rural areas, if you think of rural Tanzania, how do farmers get information about new seed varieties or new technologies that the research institutes are working on? Well, you know, they don't, so they're kind of stuck doing what they used to do, whereas climates are changing and soils are changing and they need to update what they're doing. So radio, if you ask a farmer in those conditions, radio is the only contact they might have. You know, they don't get internet, they don't have newspapers, they'll go to the market and chat with people, and perhaps the only other source of information or news or anything will be via radio. Well, my job used to be split. Some of it was project management and some of it was the proposal writing side, the fundraising side. So it was quite useful to be in Arusha so that I could go and see the projects that we were working on and, you know, make sure things are moving along as they were supposed to. So I used to travel a lot because I was responsible for East Africa.
I have some questions about Arusha. So I went there for 2 days, you know, before and then one day after, so not really. And it seemed like quite a big tourist place. Is it a big tourist city?
Pretty much. Yeah, I mean, it's packed with hotels. The number of hotels there, you know, is crazy for the population size, really. The population size and the sort of levels of, you know, economic income and whatever. That's the tourism industry. And it's all around, climbing Kilian, going on safari. But the thing is, you know, people probably much like you fly into the airport, spend one night in Arusha and then go off either up the mountain or on safari. So while it is very touristy, it's very transient. You know, you don't see so much of it, as it were. Or you get, it's also quite full of backpackers and young volunteers. There's a few NGOs, not as many as in Dar. There's a few around, but there's quite a lot of volunteering opportunities for young people, you know, 20, 22-year-olds come and help out in an orphanage. There seems to be quite an industry of orphanages going on, and teaching, you know, a few things like that, which, you know, not always very well run, and not always run for the right reason. There were some very shady characters running organizations out there. Yeah.
I'm just going to ask you some questions that we're calling the Fat Five, or we're testing it all out. On a scale of 1 to 10, rate the level of in love you were with the city when you left.
When I left, it would probably have been around 4.
Okay, and that was because you were ready?
That was because we were ready to go, yeah. If you'd asked me at year 2, I was in love on a scale of 10. Yes, I never wanted to leave.
What was the best local find you had there?
Local find. There's a few very small businesses, or a couple of gardens where you could go and sit and get a cup of tea and watch the wildlife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What drove you crazy?
Never knowing when the power and the water would be on at the same time.
Mm.
That drove me slightly crazy. And sometimes the timing issues. Let's have a meeting at 2 o'clock and people rock up at 2:40 and think it's fine. You know, even after 20 years of experiencing that, it still drives me slightly crazy.
Where's somewhere you never want to go back to? Could be anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world.
Never want to go back to. Wow, I can't even think of anywhere.
That's good.
Yeah, I can't. Nowhere is springing to mind, not even somewhere in the UK that's horrible.
What's the best piece of advice you were ever given about your expat life or a place you lived?
You'll never be the same as the people who live there, so don't try to be one of them. Oh, I think
that is interesting. Yeah. What's one place you'd love to live?
On a tropical beach, maybe somewhere like Boracay in the Philippines, or one of the tiny islands off the coast of Brazil.
And what's the biggest lesson you've learned being an expat, or what being an expat has taught you?
Patience, probably. Patience, you know, everybody, people are the same mostly, but they just do things differently. So you have to have patience to get through that.
What an interesting job, though. Like, what an interesting job. I loved how she said, you'll never be the same as the people who live there, so don't try and be the same. I thought that was a brilliant piece of expat advice.
Yeah, I agree, because it's one of those things that you, when you think about it, makes perfect sense, but you don't always necessarily think about it. The other thing was, yeah, patience. I could have used some patience this week.
I loved your questions for the Fat Five. I think we definitely have to continue this on each week. So next week we'll do B. Funny how she was really ready to go. You know, like you hear about people that live in tourist destinations where it's full of lovely hotels and, you know, there's a sort of that with tourist destinations comes kind of lighthearted, easygoing atmosphere, and you'd think someone would stay forever. But yet she was very definite on, no, we were done. You know, if you would have asked me a couple of years ago, yeah, I would have rated it much higher, but we were really done. It's incredible. When you're done when it comes to expat locations, isn't it? Nikki, books, podcasts, what we're reading, what we're watching, something we talk about every week. But before we roll into it, because I am really keen to talk about this one, I just thought maybe we should have a listen to Julia, who was one of those clever listeners of ours who went to our website, twofatexpats.com, saw the microphone on the page, pushed it, and left us this message.
Hi. I really enjoyed your podcast. This is Julia West speaking from Kampala. And in particular, I wanted to thank you for your recommendations for the Netflix series. I'm always looking for good things to watch when the TV selection here isn't great. And in return, I'd like to offer 2 recommendations of my own. Fargo, there are 3 seasons of it set in Minnesota. They're loosely connected, but each series in itself is a good story. And also the series Dr. Foster from the BBC set in the UK. There are two series of that so far. Both worth watching, I think. So thanks for those recommendations. And if you want to read a really uplifting book, I recommend The Book of Joy, which records conversations between the Dalai Lama and Bishop Desmond Tutu on the occasion of the Dalai Lama's birthday. And they spent a week together and had conversations on a variety of different topics, but essentially on how to create more joy in the world, which can't be a bad thing. Anyway, that's enough from me. Thanks again, and I'll be listening soon. Bye.
Excellent. Actually, Kirsty, have you ever watched Fargo? Have you watched Fargo on Netflix
or somewhere else? But it's on my list. It's on my list. I think we've talked about it before. I haven't. And it was a movie first, wasn't it, Fargo? In fact,
it was a movie a lot.
Yeah. And wasn't that Oscar lady?
Frances McDormand.
Yes, that's right. Okay, Nikki, I want to talk about podcasts this week. I'm not even going to pretend that we're going to get into books, movies, telly, because this week I think there was this particular podcast episode was so massive that I would really love to talk to you more about it, and I would love to hear back from our listeners and readers if they had also listened and what they thought. So it's This American Life was my first love in podcasting, as was Ira Glass. This week they had an episode called Five Women, and it was quite beautiful at the beginning when Ira sort of said, this is really good, because it made all the long-term This American Life listeners go, oh, he doesn't usually say that. It was phenomenal. So a quick recap to explain. The story is based around Don Hazen, who was an editor at Alternate and had also worked, I think, as a publisher at Mother Jones, but a man who is now in his 60s, but very powerful in the editorial world in the US. The story is about the women involved in the hashtag MeToo in regards to Don Hazen. So it was recently exposed, I think, maybe back in December on BuzzFeed and then on HuffPost about Don Hazen and the way that he behaved in the workplace and professionally and different cases of sexual harassment. But what made this story so unique is they didn't talk to Don at all. They stayed away from him and his story. We heard the stories of the five women I'm sure there were far more than five that were a part of this story, but we heard from five women who all had worked with him and been involved with him. And that was anything from his partner Vivian to his mistress Deanne, and a couple of women who he worked with, Kristen and Tana, who had both been sexually harassed at work and both had different stories. And what made it so interesting was they took you back with each woman and talked about their history with men, so that you kind of understood where they were coming from when they got to the point in their lives where they met Don. How did it affect you, Nikki? What did you think of it? Am I raving too much? Was it as good as I'm saying it is? What were your thoughts?
I think the thing about This American Life, which is, yes, everyone's a favourite original podcast, I guess, is that it takes things that if you listen to it just by itself, it just sound like everyday things, but it makes it an extraordinary story from it. And I'm not saying what happened to these women were everyday things, but if you listen to each of these stories individually or without the context of the bigger picture, they're just so clever that the way they do it, in the way that it can be guided and meshed and put together to show this story. And you're right in what you're saying about it takes us from the lives of these women. I mean, one of these women, I don't know if it was Deanna or Tana, was sexually harassed in one of her first jobs, and her parents said, well, of course you will be. You know, you're a young
girl. Yeah, that was Tana. That was Tana. Yeah, it was like, of course you were sexually harassed, you fool. You know, yeah. And the way she said, she so dramatically said, Mum, Dad, I've been sexually harassed. And they were like, yeah. But I think that showed so much about Tana, and that's why this story was so good, was we heard a lot about Tana from the fact that she thought she was from, you know, she's younger, far younger than I am, and she's gone the full circle of she thinks this whole feminism business and people sort of going on about it is way too much, you know, that it's an overreaction. And it was almost like she lost her innocence in a way, that she really thought that women were stronger than that and they could do more. And so when it happened to her, she was, you know, quite shocked.
I know, but even that her parents would say that to her, sorry to harp on that, but it's just so much part of the fact that this Me Too and Never Again movement is really, it's a very now thing. You know, people have talked in the past, and feminists have talked in the past about equality and harassment and things like that, but they've spoken about it and people have thought, oh, well, it happens. Like, we should stop it, but whatever. And I just really feel this moment in time now is really bringing to a head a lot of things. So particularly if you look at this guy, the stories over the years, and even Vivian, who is his partner of 20 years and was, you know, the reporter asked her about the BuzzFeed article, which she said she read, and she said, sure, she recognized some of the things he said and did in it, and then other parts she just didn't recognize at all. So it's kind of one of those things where putting the whole story together and listening here each part of it, that's another part of why this was so well produced and so well done, because they take each part, each story, and weave them in together, so you get such a big full picture.
Yeah, and they kick off the story with Vivian, who has been his partner for 20 years, and like you were saying, she said she didn't recognize the man that they were talking about. But I wonder if that's possibly because she's never really met that man. She's never seen him like that. I think one of the really interesting things, and I had one of those moments of, I've done that, of, you know, she was explaining being at university and that she had worked alongside a particularly attractive supervisor, you know, professor, and that the women sort of fawned on him, and she was saying, you know, she really didn't think that his words were, you know, that fawnable as such, but she was saying she was sitting next to a colleague, a woman she obviously had a lot of respect for, and they looked over at all these women hanging on the edge of every word that this man said, and the other woman went, oh, the cupcakes. And that's how she referred to those type of women, women who hang on every, you know, word that a man says and kind of flirt around him and whatever. And I just thought, A, I'm guilty of that. I'm guilty at
judging other women.
Judging other women and deciding that they're, you know, they're fairy floss, you know, they're just pretty young things without much thought. Do you know, like I'm guilty of thinking that they're not strong. But also it made me wonder, you know, it was so good that they chose that story, because when she talked about her feelings of being out with him, that she knew he was a flirt, and she talked about how she knew he was a flirt because they'd go out and he'd be inappropriate with women, like overly flirtatious. And she just felt that he didn't read the signs well, that he wasn't intuitive enough to pick up that he'd gone too far, and how she would look at these women and kind of raise her eyebrows as if to say, oh yeah, he's a bit of a pain, isn't he, and oh, I'm sorry about that. But you know, almost conspiratorially together, that she would be saying that, and I guess really when you think about it now, making excuses, but was she looking at them like they were just cupcakes? I don't know.
I'm not sure. Well, it kind of takes us to Deanna, which I found almost the most fascinating, yes, of the five,
yes,
women, because she met him. Apparently it was his regular pickup style, was to sort of offer an opportunity and then mentor her, and then sort of he had this relationship with her, sexual relationship with her, and then seemed surprised when she didn't know that he actually had a long-term partner. And she said she got really angry about it. And then she sort of thought, well, you know, but given her background and given the fact that she had grown up and boys her age, she didn't like them. She thought, you know, they're silly and dumb, and she was kind of a bit better. And when she'd met him and he was a bit older and he didn't want everything from her, she could sort of make the relationship on her own terms. She thought that was good. And she was happy with that and kind of felt like she was in a more controlling position for herself.
Yeah, she kind of carried all her other boyfriends, hadn't she? She looked after them or put up with them. Yes. And you know, she kept saying that her parents had kind of taught her that boys were never going to get her because she was so strong and smart and men wouldn't be able to make sense of it, that they were too dumb to work that out. But I wonder how many women, when she describes the first time when she got into bed with Don, how they ended up having sex and how it was a bit of a surprise to her. You know, she thought they were just fooling around and then next minute he'd sort of taken it a step too far. And when she talked about that slow conversation that went into her head, you know, where she rationalized it, you know, because there was no condom and she was all, oh, this is all right because of this, 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 and this. And I just thought, oh, there would be a lot of women out there going, I've been that woman. I have put up with this and given it another word.
Sorry. And several years later when he said, oh, we shouldn't have sex because I have an STD.
Yes.
And she's
Oh, yes. And what was interesting was we hear all this stuff about Deanna and we think about how strong she is and how she was kind of, I guess anyone else looking at it from the outside as another woman, you would say, well, she holds the power here because she wasn't his wife. She wasn't acting like his wife. She was quite happy for him to come into town. So the deal was she lived in New York. He was in California. He would come into town. They would spend time together. I gather he would buy all the dinners, you know, that there's a mention of he bought her a laptop, you know, that he gave her lots of work, that they had this very strong relationship. You know, if when you hear it from her half, it's all about, you know, that they were equals and he listened to her opinions and thoughts and that she had this respect for him because of his age. But then we meet Anisha and she tells us that her first memory is of watching Deanna cut up his meat at a work thing. So you go, did Deanna not realise that she was – that these things were happening? Was this all, you know, was it chip by chip by chip by chip? Was he doing these things? But the bit about Anisha I loved is we hear about when Anisha goes back and she tells us about her stories of growing up and men, and she talks about being at the pool with a group of boys. They were all working together. It was all fun. You can identify with this whole summer, kids at the pool, kids hanging out. They get to a certain age where the boys start talking about the girls differently and they're talking about the hypnotizer and she wants to be in a part of the story. And so she pushes to go, you know, who is this hypnotizer? Because they were saying that this hypnotizer looked amazing in her bathers and she would, you know, hypnotize the boys. And eventually one of them tells her that it's her. And she gives the most incredible description of she put herself into two separate girls and that she realized that some of us merged those two girls where we're bikini girl, hypnotizer girl and everyday girl. And some of us just separate those girls because we don't want to be objectified and we decide. And I think, you know, I always have thought it's interesting with the way women dress. You know, I have never been a short skirts, plunging tops sort of dresser, right? I have plenty of friends that do dress that way and I have no judgment and they usually have amazing bodies as well. I mean, maybe that's part of it. I don't have that body. I don't have long, skinny legs and, you know, voluptuous buzzies that stand up on their own. But there is a definite thing where you see there are different types of women that hold their power in different ways. And Is that whole how you dress? Is it your fashion sense or is it your strategy?
And I was so sad for her when she told that story about the pool, because that changed her whole life. When she found that out, that was it for her. Like, she could no longer feel comfortable wearing a bathing suit to the pool. Like, she just didn't feel comfortable anymore. And it just, it has impacted her. I felt like that was really the crux of her story, because it totally impacted her up until the time that she sat down and told this story.
And, you know, I had a moment very much like that as a 12-year-old girl. And because I was a swimmer and all the boys and girls all used to hang out and swim together. I'd been a swimmer since I was 8. And I do remember being at the pool and all the boys standing there talking to me, and one of them had a bit of a smirk and then there was a giggle. And then later on a friend let me know that they were all trying to see if they could see through my bathers. Do you know, and it was that moment of what? Why? Do you know, like, what? Why would they do that? And suddenly I wasn't one of them anymore. So I think so many women have their moment like that where someone comments on their body or does something, and they suddenly realize that, oh, we're not all in the same sort of playing field again.
We're not the same.
Yeah.
And it's happened so young for so many people, and that's really sad part of it.
Yeah. Then we hear about Tana, and I found her very interesting in the way that she knew that she, someone said to her when she took the job, oh, you'll definitely be sexually harassed if you take that job. And the way that she had that in her head that was going to happen, and how I think she thought she was going to be able to manipulate it in a certain way and deal with him in a certain way, that, you know, then not wanting to jump too far ahead, but when we meet Kristen, who's the next woman who also works in the same environment, to me they were two women, both with similar stories of working for him, but one woman refused to accept the bullshit and the other woman accepted it and almost took a bit of blame and responsibility for it, of, I haven't set the boundaries, I haven't told him the rules, he's older, he's, you know, when they talked about he would invite women to his apartment for work, and Tana, who was more inclined to make excuses, said she could understand why because there wasn't an office in New York, whereas Kristen couldn't understand why they had to go to his apartment. It didn't make any sense to her. It's that whole how we've been raised and what's happened to us in the past, because then we find out that Kristen has actually been raped as a young woman. And she's already, in my mind, she's got the head of a 50-year-old woman, in that she's already been through enough crap with men to go, this isn't cool, I know what this is, we're not going to pretend it's something else and give it another name, you know, this is sexual harassment.
It was interesting because when you read the Huffington Post article, Kristen had tweeted and shared the BuzzFeed article. Obviously the HuffPost came afterwards. And she said, working at Alternet was the most helpless I ever felt in my life, but I was never weak. And now Don has no choice but to realize how strong and powerful the women he mistreated have always been.
Yes.
She talks about the weak. The Huffington Post article says that the women involved were unaware of the company protocol available to them to report harassment.
He was so clever in the way he hired these women. I think it was really insightful into how you get a job. If someone gives you an opportunity and your feeling of having to be grateful for that opportunity, and how many of those women felt that they kind of owed him something and that he'd given them a chance. And I wonder if that almost convinced him that he was some sort of feminist because he did it. Because, you know, there's this great moment in the podcast where he's you know, trying to have sex with Deanna, and after he's told her he's had the STD. And then he gets so angry with her and says, you know, I'm a feminist, you know, or how dare you say that about me? You know, I'm one of the biggest feminists. And you go, oh my gosh, you're delusional. You actually really believe that.
And I think, look, if you look at what he did, it's a form of grooming. I'm thinking if you sort of laid it all out step by step, it's not dissimilar the way that he interacted with the women. and they ended up in somewhere they totally didn't want to be, but not always sure exactly how they got
there. Yes, yes. I think it's that whole thing about being a woman and surrounding yourself with other good women too, because a lot of, you know, you say, well, why did it take until someone like Kristen, who was the youngest employee in the firm or at Alternet, she was the youngest employee at Alternet, like why did it take her out of all those women to sort of stand up and be counted? And in the end, you know, she couldn't until, you know, much later she ended up just leaving. But I thought there was so much of her young life where her friends got together and talked about their situations and talked about things that boys had done to them. And they're these situations that I, as a young woman, you know, drunken at parties, things happen, there's confusion about yes or no or consent. And all these things where she's obviously sat with a lot of friends and had a lot of conversations about the different ways that things are presented. She said something about, because she talked about a situation of being in a room at a party, being really drunk enough that her, you know, her face was numb, and how this, she could hear banging on the door, and she realized later it was because the boy had locked the door and got into bed with her, and it was someone else banging on the door to get in. But she was saying, as young women, you know, you live in fear that you're going to get raped in an alley, but you don't think about the subtleness of the things that can happen to you. She used the term, you know, where people just scrape under the line and what they can get away with, and that you'll start to doubt yourself because it's not the worst example, it's not as clear cut. And I think that's the thing about sexual harassment in the workplace. There's so many things where we go, is that sexual harassment? I don't know. Is he, can you say that? Should you done that? And you don't question enough about how awkward it makes you feel. I mean, when your boss says, I saw someone on the internet and she looks just like you, and it turns out it's a porn star. And she says, oh, great. So every blonde chick in a porn movie reminds him of me. Do you know, but the way that he has come out and said, no, it was just a movie star or whatever. You know, you can see how he would have been justifying his behavior all the way through.
The reporter asks Vivian, you know, had she ever thought, Vivian being his partner, had she ever thought to speak to him about his behavior? And she said no, because he wouldn't believe me. He'd just say that's just the way he is. That's just the way the world is.
Which is almost kind of gaslighting, isn't it? Like maybe he's been gaslighting her all the way through. For, you're silly. You're just seeing things. I'm not like that. You're being ridiculous. I'm just chatting. It's just friendly banter, you know, all that sort of stuff. You're crazy.
I don't recall, but did they speak to her at all about his ongoing long-term affair with Deanna?
No,
did she comment on that? Because I know they talked to Vivian at the beginning and then at the end.
Well, it was all brand new to her. She'd only had a month to digest it. So she had no idea about the affair until a month ago of when they recorded. So there was this sort of awkward moment where they say, oh, you didn't know about the affair. No, I'm processing all of this information right now. So, you know, because I think the most shocking thing for a lot of women was she said she was 99.9% sure that their relationship would stay, that they would stay together, that they would weather through this. But she seemed more... And who knows whether it's a matter of editing and that it's all still fresh, but it seemed she seemed more betrayed by the relationship that he had with Deanna than she was by all of the sexual harassment and his behaviour at work. I don't know if you remember, she talked about, you know, they were watching a movie and she was thinking, did you lay like that with her in bed, or did you listen to this music with her?
Yeah.
Those sort of things seemed to worry her more than were you highly inappropriate and showed a picture of your penis to a 21-year-old woman at work. I mean, that would have me running out the door in a heartbeat. You know, more than the affair.
No to G. Affairs are fine. Don't show pictures of your penis.
Anyway, I just thought it was brilliant, Nikki. I thought it was such a fantastic piece of podcasting. I did like at the end they mentioned it had been inspired from an episode of I Love Dick, which is a television show I haven't watched as yet, but I'm going to. Just moving right along, I'm reading I Am Malala at the moment. I'm sort of halfway through, so I'll talk about that more next week. Are you reading anything, Nikki?
I'm not reading anything now. I've got some podcasts I want to talk about, but I'll wait till next time. And just quickly, the television, Netflix, The End of the Effing World. I don't know if anyone's seen it. It's worth a look. You look at it, you think, don't think I'd like that, but it's kind of very dark comedy. So it's not for the under 16 crowd, I don't think, or maybe even the under 18 crowd. A 17-year-old, his name is James. He's bored with killing animals, so he's busy planning his first murder. And it kind of goes from there.
we're still on season 2 of The American, so I have no television to report. But I think we've gone quite heavy on the Five Women podcast this week. So maybe we'll come back with some more suggestions. Yep. I will put a link in there, though, of a great New York Times article about the woman who realized her husband was gay. It's a beautiful piece and incredibly sad, as you can imagine. But there was one sentence in it that I just thought was absolutely beautiful. It's a moment in it where she's been cutting his hair throughout their marriage, and then she realizes that they're going to have to say goodbye, that she has to stop doing this, that this part of their relationship has to change. And he asks if he can stay in their bed just one more time. And he says, "I lay awake on my back. She rested her hand on my neck. I turned to my right side and she to her left as we twisted in our bittersweet ballet of goodbye."
Oh, yes, lovely writing.
Beautiful. Okay, I'm going to say goodbye, Nikki, because I'm down to 1% on my computer. So I'll talk to you next week.
Goodbye from you.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Speak to you later. Bye.